I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in 1964, Fact magazine surveyed psychiatrists about Barry Goldwater's mental health. They published their results under the headline, 1,189 psychiatrists say Goldwater is psychologically unfit to be president. Well, Goldwater sued for libel and won, although he lost the White House to Lyndon Johnson. The American Psychiatric Association now includes the so-called Goldwater rule in its code of ethics. You can't offer a professional opinion about a public figure's mental health if you have not formally evaluated them. The APA reiterated that rule recently in response to Donald Trump being called a narcissist, even a sociopath. Today on the show, we want to talk about the personality traits of public figures, especially those running for the White House, and the pros and cons of diagnosing them. And we have two guests who have joined us by telephone. Nasir Ghami is a professor of psychiatry, director of the Mood Disorders Program at Tufts Medical Center, wrote a book called First Rate Madness, uncovering the links between leadership and mental illness. Nasir Ghami, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Also with us is Dan McAdams. He's a professor of psychology at Northwestern University. He wrote a book called George Bush and the Redemptive Dream, A Psychological Portrait. And Dan McAdams, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And Dan, let me begin with you. Why do you think Donald Trump has generated much more armchair diagnosis analysis than Clinton or any previous candidate than I can recall, except maybe Barry Goldwater?
Well, he's an interesting candidate. I mean, I had an opportunity to do so when the Atlantic Monthly editors called me back in February and asked me to do a personality portrait of Donald Trump, which I subsequently did. I spent 3 months on it. I wouldn't have done it had they not asked me, but I can see the appeal of trying to figure out a man who, first of all, is so much in the public eye, and secondly, seems by many accounts, at least, to show such extreme kinds of behavior that turn people's heads.
Do you think it's as large, and I'm looking at the piece that you wrote, The Mind of Donald Trump, is it because he has such a large and perhaps politically unconventional personality?
He has an unconventional personality, I think, and I think many people look at it and it scares them a little bit, or they may find it fascinating, or both. And, you know, he's out there so much, and he's been out there for so long, and yet I think many of us feel we don't fully understand him. In the piece I did, the kind of the opening conceit is, you know, people see Donald Trump and they go, whoa, it's like that's Donald Trump playing Donald Trump. It's as if he's playing a role, but, like, who is he really when you get beyond the role? And that became the fundamental question for the piece.
And I will explore that piece with you. Nasir, let me get you in on the conversation. First of all, what is the Goldwater rule?
Well, the Goldwater rule basically, as you pointed out, came from 50 years ago when there was this magazine piece where over 1,000 psychiatrists said he was unfit to be president. And the basic idea is that you shouldn't make a comment on a public figure unless you personally examine them and have their consent.
Do you stand by that? Do you think the Golden Rule should apply? Or, excuse me, the Goldwater Rule should apply?
Well, the audience should probably know the difference here that we're talking about psychiatrists who are physicians, medical doctors, and part of the American Psychiatric Association, which is a different group than psychologists like Dr. McAdams, who are PhDs and not physicians, per se. And psychologists aren't restricted by the American Psychiatric Association rule. But for us psychiatrists, this restriction exists. My own view is that it's too strict. It's a form of extreme self-censorship. But that it has an insight within it, which is this. It's very easy for psychiatrists, like any human being, to take their own personal political opinions and pejoratively use psychiatric phrases, like narcissism, the most common, for an expression of their political opinions. And that is something we should not do. However, I think the rule itself is wrong in the sense that I think that there are many ways in which, with adequate documentation, one can make a judgment that a public figure, especially one in the past who may not be alive, had a psychiatric disease or illness, and that shouldn't be restricted.
And just following up on what you just said there, so looking at a book someone might have written or a speech that they gave or a tweet that they might have tweeted out, all that is the potential to come up, if not with a diagnosis, at least a description of a certain personality, Nasir?
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's the concept of having to personally examine the person, the patient, is exaggerated, because we make psychiatric diagnoses all the time, like in emergency rooms, in which we ignore what the patient says and we listen to what the EMT says or what the policeman says about what they were doing. People often don't tell the truth about, or don't even know necessarily about, their psychiatric states. So the personal examination really shouldn't be the focus. I think we should be broader and say, for instance, if someone has sent a letter in which they say they're suicidal, that's an expression of depression. That's a rational interpretation.
Dan, let me go back to you. And quoting from your piece, you write, for psychologists, it's almost impossible to talk about Donald Trump without using the word narcissism. And then you quote Howard Gardner and some other psychologists. Do you see a difference between psychologists and psychiatrists and what they can do or say about a public figure?
I do, but I would frame the distinction a little differently. I think it's a distinction between evaluations of mental health and illness on the one hand, and those could be done by psychiatrists, but those can also be done by psychologists and other mental health experts. So that's one side of the ledger. And then you have the study or commentary on social, personality, developmental psychology from the standpoint of the discipline, those particular disciplines. And that's not about diagnosis. It's not about illness. It's not about sickness and health. It's about, what does a person's life mean? What are the main traits that run through their personality? And I think that kind of a commentary, psychological commentary on people's lives, be they public figures or not, is fair game. I think it's really kind of outside the bounds of the Goldwater rule.
And Dan, what creates, or do we know how a narcissist is made, or perhaps is raised or develops?
Right. So the term narcissist is problematic as a type. It makes it sound like, you know, this is a particular kind of person. We've got narcissists out there and we've got non-narcissists. And the way the term, I think, should be used is to relate to a particular theme in a person's life. And there are many themes. So when it comes to narcissism, we're talking about motivation. What gets a person going? When they wake up in the morning, what are they striving to achieve? And people who have narcissistic goals, like Mr. Trump, are all about promoting the self, adoring the self, loving the self. This becomes the number one motivational idea for them. But it's not a type of person. It's just one theme in their lives. I mean, Donald Trump also has a set of personality traits. He has a set of mental habits. He has a life narrative that is part of his personality. There are many parts to Donald Trump. The theme of narcissistic goals is just one part. And so it does come up in the article, well, like, how is it that he became so enamored with these narcissistic goals? And it's kind of a mystery. We don't really know why. I mean, there's one theory out there, is that you just don't get enough reinforcement early in life, and therefore you're always trying to compensate for that by striving to promote the self. However, there's very little evidence of that in Mr. Trump's life. I mean, from an early age, he was clearly a favorite of his father's and got a lot of positive reinforcement. So that theory of why you become so enamored with narcissistic goals doesn't seem to hold for him.
Nasir, let me go back to you. I mean, what public figure doesn't have narcissistic tendencies, especially if they're running for the White House?
Well, I don't like the word narcissism from a scientific perspective. It's not a scientifically well supported concept. It's essentially a literary metaphor invented by one person, Sigmund Freud, about 100 years ago, and it's been repeated and repeated since then. But it's not a scientifically sound concept. We could just as well just use the phrase high self-esteem, if that's what we mean by it, and then a lot of the pejorative connotations are lost.
Well, I looked it up, and one of the, I guess it's a checklist for narcissism: interest in self, grandiosity, the need for admiration, the lack of empathy, the desire for attention. Does that fit what we're talking about here, Nasir?
The problem with what you looked up is you're reflecting criteria for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, which is psychiatry's main definitional textbook for diagnoses. This is a larger debate, but the summary of my view of it is that the majority of those diagnoses do not have sound scientific bases for them. So really, that's not the place to go to say, what does the science show? Yeah, you could quote all those things, but right. The scientific research has shown, for instance, that narcissistic personality disorder is not really a valid diagnosis in the sense that it can be shown that's independent from other personality conditions or other diagnoses which have similar symptoms like manic depression, for instance.
So what, I mean, we're focusing on Donald Trump because I guess of his large personality, but we should also include Hillary Clinton in our discussion as well. Nasir, do you feel comfortable from afar making commentary about what you see in these two people?
Well, you know, in the first rate madness, I made psychiatric diagnoses in about a dozen historical and political leaders,
right,
all of whom have been dead for about 50 years in the case of the diagnoses I made. And one of the conclusions I came to is that people need to be dead for about 50 years before adequate documentation becomes available to make psychiatric diagnoses, meaning medical records are released, private letters become public, close friends feel comfortable giving oral histories, talking about the personal lives of people. One of the problems we have with living figures like these individuals is that everybody is hiding their own psychiatric histories and psychological states. And so it's hard to make good judgments because we don't have a lot of documentation, which is one reason why I think a good step forward would be to require presidential candidates to give not only medical but psychiatric information to the public in their medical histories and so on, to make that public and allow us to have that kind of information.
Danny, can you respond to that, since you wrote a book called George Bush and the Redemptive Dream, A Psychological Portrait, and George Bush is very much with us?
There are a number of factors there. I mean, first of all, I agree with the idea that narcissistic personality disorder is a problematic diagnosis. There's a lot of reasons to have problems with that particular diagnosis, NPD, and so I try to just completely avoid it as a diagnosis or as a type, and again, referring to a motivational approach, an approach that is mainly about self-reference. It does go with high self-esteem sometime, but there is a lot of research to suggest that it's not just high self-esteem. With respect to the, you know, why not diagnose? Well, if I don't sort of diagnose, so I'm kind of out of that game. But just thinking about, you know, let's wait 50 years before we do it, when all the documentation comes in, that makes some good sense to me. I like that idea. There's also the issue of the fact that the man is dead, or the woman, and so there's no way in which these particular diagnoses, if you will, are going to sort of impact that person directly since they're deceased. Beyond that, though, I have trouble with the notion that we should be putting out there psychiatric diagnoses or psychiatric evaluations for current people in the current sphere, I mean, running for office and so on. I mean, I don't think when it comes to Donald Trump, for example, there are so many reasons to either vote for him or not vote for him based on who he is as a person, his identity, also his values, his goals, his policies and so forth. I'm not sure that the psychiatric stuff actually has that much bearing beyond all that. I mean, you can look at his personality traits, for example. This isn't psychiatric diagnosis. This is a personality description. He's an extremely extroverted person who's very low on the trait of agreeableness. Now, that's not diagnosis. There's all kinds of research on those two traits, and what that combination tells you in the literature is that this is a person who's likely to take big risks in a bold way on the public stage without a lot of concern for the collateral damage that may follow. I didn't use a psychiatric term there. I'm not talking about mental illness. I'm talking about a style of social behavior that has been shown in the research to apply to people who have this trait profile. Not every one of them. It's a probabilistic kind of evaluation, but it's information that I think can be used to think about whether or not I want to vote for this particular man.
Well, hold
it's
on.
Not psychiatric.
Dan, only because we're up on a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Dan McAdams. Also with us, Nasir Ghami. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowe, and we're talking about the pros and cons of of evaluating the mental state of public figures, or perhaps even the mental health of public figures. Dan McAdams is our guest, professor of psychology at Northwestern University, wrote a book called George Bush and the Redemptive Dream, A Psychological Portrait. Also with us is Nasir Ghami, professor of psychiatry and director of the Mood Disorders Program at Tufts Medical Center. He wrote a book called First Rate Madness, Uncovering the Links Between Leadership and Mental Illness. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Nasir, what I heard Dan say right before the break is that there really is a difference between a diagnosis, where you come up with an actual diagnosis from the DSM, versus a description of a certain personality style, certain features that seem to be very on display. Do you see a difference there? Are you comfortable with that?
Yes, and I agree with Dr. McAdams, and I think that his article on Mr. Trump focused on these personality traits that are really well proven scientifically, like extroversion and anxiety and so on. And I would agree with that it's like being tall or being short. It's not a diagnosis. It's just an extreme of a normal trait. I would look at it another way, and this is complementary to that approach, is I focus on the research on depression and mania. And in mood illnesses, people can have mild manic symptoms, for instance, where they're high in their energy, talkative, a lot of sexual drive, creative, productive. A lot of these people are entrepreneurs and leaders. And they also can have some limitations, like decreased empathy and some impulsivity. And we call this hyperthymia or hyperthymic temperament. And sometimes it can also alternate with some depressive symptoms, so it's called cyclothymia. And that actually was diagnosed, for instance, in Winston Churchill by his physicians, and I think correctly so. And I've made similar diagnoses in John Kennedy and Franklin Roosevelt. And all these traits can make a leader stronger in times of crises, I've argued, but also weaker when there's not a crisis and they have limitations. So I think it is reasonable to consider that kind of analysis, and it's not a diagnosis in a traditional psychiatric sense, but it's about personality traits and personality types.
Let me quote a line from your book. You write, "The best crisis leaders are either mentally ill or mentally abnormal. The worst crisis leaders are mentally healthy." That's a pretty provocative thing to say.
Right. Well, I make this distinction between crisis leadership and non-crisis leadership. When things are going well and all you need to do is keep the trains running on time, you do want a stable, mentally healthy person who isn't going to change much running things. But when you're in a time of crisis and the past doesn't predict the future anymore, you do need somebody who's very creative, who's willing to take risks. And, you know, somewhat ironically, the leaders that we value the most have been people who've had either severe depression, straightforward bipolar illness, or these mild manic and depressive symptoms as part of their personality, like hyperthymia and cyclothymia. And the people that have sometimes failed in those crises have been very mentally healthy, stable individuals.
Have we had a president without these kinds of mental issues who has been a good president from your perspective, Nasir?
Well, again, Calvin Coolidge, you could say, was a good president in the time of peace and prosperity. But Franklin Roosevelt was the kind of president you needed in a time of crisis. I think it's not necessarily good or bad. It's the differences, positive and negative aspects to both mental abnormality or mental illness and mental health, and that they correlate in different ways in times of crisis and non-crisis periods.
Is it fair for me to ask you about how you think about President Obama in that he's still president and still alive, kind of breaking your rule there, Nasir?
Well, it doesn't totally break my rule. I was asked about him when First Rate Madness came out just before the 2012 election, a good deal. And I wrote about George W. Bush and indeed Richard Nixon in the sense that it's current documentation doesn't allow us to make psychiatric diagnoses. There's enough evidence to say that they have bipolar illness or depression, for instance, and their personality traits, again, one could look at this in more detail as Dr. McAdams has, seem more or less within the normal range, which means that they're not abnormal in their personality traits or extreme, and they're not psychiatrically diagnosable, which means they're basically within the range of normal mental health. And that's the way I look at all these recent leaders. And it doesn't break any rules because I'm not diagnosing them with anything. And that means perhaps that if we had a major crisis, they might not be the best kind of leaders. On the other hand, they're quite good for limited crises and for the usual run-of-the-mill decision-making that's needed in government.
Dan, going back to your piece in The Atlantic, you talk about the big five: extroversion, neuroticism, conscientiousness, agreeableness, and openness. What do we need to know about those features, those personality types?
Sure. Well, those traits, those five big traits, have been derived again and again in research in personality psychology over the last 30, 40 years. And so there's a lot of literature speaking to the validity of each. And they all basically focus on a style of public performance. So they get you a first cut in personality, and then you want to get beyond that to get at a person's goals and values and to get at their life narrative. But the traits are useful. I think they are helpful to give you a first cut, and they're the kinds of things that are pretty broadly observable in social behavior. I mean, there's a lot of consensus on these things. So take President Obama, for example. Again, this isn't diagnosis. This is just a commentary. But there's a trait called neuroticism there, and people high in neuroticism have a lot of anxiety, a lot of negative emotion. They get riled up easily. Obama is almost like weirdly low on that trait. I mean, he is extreme on the low end of neuroticism in that he seems extraordinarily unflappable and calm. And some people would say, to his perhaps detriment in some cases, because he just seems all so dispassionate. But I think the traits are useful for getting you a sense of a person's emotional and behavioral style.
Let me go back to you, Natsir, and I know you have to leave us in just a couple of minutes. Having looked at a number of former presidents, do presidents have daddy issues? From what you've been able to glean?
I don't go there in my analysis. I view that kind of interpretation as too difficult to make. And in this sense, I think the Goldwater rule is great. It's very difficult to make unless you know the person well individually. I try to stick with more, as Dr. McAdams said, also more observable external traits like depression and manic symptoms, because manic depressive illness is one of the most definitively established psychiatric diagnoses scientifically. And if I can say this, for instance, I would say that the description of hyperthymia, hyperthymic temperament that I gave, is something that would fit a lot of what Mr. Trump has described about himself and said about himself, or that we know about him. That would explain a lot of his strengths and a lot of his limitations. But I do want to add, in addition to what Dr. McAdams said, my own view is that these are limited in terms of making judgments about people. Like, these kinds of assessments are enough to say, we should support this person or not, and that's where other aspects of the person's leadership comes in, including their specific ideology, whether they're leading us where we want to go. So, for instance, as a Muslim American, I'm not particularly likely to see much appeal in some of Mr. Trump's approach because of his perspectives on that issue. But that's not really a reflection of a psychiatric diagnosis necessarily, or even his personality type.
But is there a risk that someone, let's say a psychiatrist who opposes Donald Trump, could substitute then a diagnosis for a disagreement?
That's the problem. And that's, I think, what the Goldwater rule is set up to argue against. All I think we've done is we've gone too far with it. And we put that rule up in the middle of the Cold War in 1964, when we almost had a nuclear war the year before. This is a very different world now, and I think by saying at the same time that you can't do what Dr. McAdams does, which is to assess personality traits, or you can't do what I did, which is to assess the people who are deceased, or even people who are alive, if we have sufficient documentation, say, of hospitalization for depression, I think that should be something we talk about. And in a weird way, by censoring ourselves so much, we are really feeding into the discrimination and stigma in our society against psychiatric illnesses, where we think it's inherently a bad thing to have them and a bad thing to talk about it. And I think psychiatrists shouldn't be in the business of adding to that discrimination. We should be trying to reduce it.
Well, Natsir Ghami, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Appreciate your input.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And he's a professor of psychiatry, director of the Mood Disorders Program at Tufts Medical Center, wrote a book called First Rate Madness, uncovering the links between leadership and mental illness. Dan McAdams staying with us for the next 20 minutes or so, and he's a professor of psychology at Northwestern University, and he wrote a book called George Bush and the Redemptive Dream, A Psychological Portrait. And we're talking about some of the pros and cons, perhaps the dangers and potential benefits of talking about the personalities of people running for the highest office in the land, and that, of course, would be for the White House. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. A bunch of comments here, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Dan, let me read a comment here talking about both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. These people have long histories, have been showing who and what they are to the media more than has ever existed before. So why not, in a sense, describe or maybe even diagnose them, since we know them so well? They've lived such a public life.
So we know them well in a way. We know their traits. We've mainly been talking about traits here, which are these observable behavioral and emotional displays that people express. But I'd like to suggest that there's really more to personality than the traits. There's more than the role that the person plays that you see and that you continue to see over time. There are the goals and the values that speak to the person's motivational agenda. And then, and this was interesting for me with Mr. Trump, there is the story that a person creates about their lives. And indeed, many people would say that a person's story, their internalized narrative that they got in their head about how they came to be and where their life is going, is a central part of their personality and their identity. And yet it is hard to see what that is until you kind of do a deep dive and try to like get materials on these people, as I did with Mr. Bush and Trump. And in the case of Donald Trump, it was a frustrating endeavor because I couldn't find much there. I mean, beyond a kind of very stripped down story that he has about his life that basically goes sort of like this: the world is a dangerous place. You have got to be really careful out there, and you have got to fight. Mm. And from a very early age, Donald Trump has seen himself as a fighter. This isn't something that's obvious necessarily in the traits, although it is somewhat consistent, but it's a myth. It's a narrative he's got in his head about, you know, what his life is about. And I kind of end the article by saying, okay, but why is he fighting? Well, I'm fighting to win, but win for what purpose? And this remains an open question. It's not clear why Mr. Trump wants to win, except to win.
Well, it's interesting, and I know you haven't done the same thing for Hillary Clinton. She, of course, wrote her own book a couple of, maybe a decade ago. I kind of lost track of that, but It Takes a Village, which I didn't interview her on it, nor have I read it. But I wonder whether someone who has these ambitions for higher office writes about their life in a very careful kind of way, knowing what they think their future might be.
Sure. She wrote a book after that one that is biographical. I can't think of the name right now of it either. I read it a while back. And she is careful. There's no doubt about that. I mean, that's kind of part of her MO. She's a pretty careful person in this regard. And it talks about, you know, her childhood and her striving and so forth. I think it's a useful document. I mean, I think there's a theme in Hillary Clinton's life that you see very early on. I think other people, her detractors and supporters, would say the same. And that, you know, she's always been the striving good girl who wants to do well. And there's a certain grittiness, there's a certain high level of drive and conscientiousness, I think, that runs with that, and it's kind of consistent with some of her ideologies and so forth. So you start to see some of that in what she's written. And if you go back to those big five traits we were talking about before the break, she doesn't really stand out on any of them in a dramatic way, except perhaps for the trait of conscientiousness, mm-hmm. Which tends to be about working hard, following the rules, but also there's a certain kind of like strong do-gooder sort of appeal there that I think sometimes rubs people the wrong way, but can also be a very positive kind of force. That you can say some things about her based on what she's written in her life, but we would need more study there.
Let me read a couple of comments. A tweet from Ben says, most of the analysis I've seen comes from people who know nothing about behavioral health. Would you agree with that, Dan?
I have to say that in doing the piece on Mr. Trump, I did run across a lot of analyses, if you will, in various magazines, internet, and so forth, that I thought were pretty weak, kind of unfounded. I mean, he does provoke really, really strong feelings in people, and I think, as our previous guest suggested, this is often an opportunity for, like, you don't agree with somebody, so let's find an illness, or let's find a diagnosis, or let's find a label. So, I think that's probably true.
I'm looking at something that came from FactCheck, which is a fact-checking organization here in Philadelphia affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania. And apparently there is a mental health record that's making the rounds about Hillary Clinton. It's false, and that doesn't seem to stop the people talking about it. It's this viral claim, medical documents purporting to be from Hillary Clinton's doctor, posted on conservative websites, claim to show Clinton suffers from seizures and dementia. Fact Check called this false. But does the fact that people seem so free and easy to talk about some of these psychological issues and even personality traits lead to something like this?
It does, although I think what we're talking about here is medical stuff, medical diagnosis, sickness, illness. I mean, these terms, when we use the word diagnosis, we're using a metaphor for life that I think isn't always the best thing to do. It suggests that people are fine for a while, and then they get sick, they get ill, they get schizophrenia, they get cancer, they get demented, okay, and then this scares us. This is something. But personality is not about illness, necessarily. It's about the kind of person you are, your identity. And so I don't have any problem with the idea that people can throw around terms having to do with the quality of a person's personality, their social relationships, even their character and morality. But when we get into the business of diagnosing illness, whether, again, it's mental illness or physical illness, or if we say, you know, she's prone to seizures, I think this is pretty pernicious. And it's one of the reasons I think that the Goldwater rule is a pretty good rule.
Do you think psychologists should have their own Goldwater rule?
I do. I mean, clinical psychologists who are making mental health judgments, and I think most of them abide by it unwittingly, implicitly anyway. I mean, it's a general view, I think, among psychologists, clinical psychologists. I'm not one of them, but I know a lot of them, that you don't just throw diagnoses around like that. And if you have a political disagreement with Mr. Trump or Mrs. Clinton, spell it out in terms of your political disagreement. And if you don't like the kind of person she is, you think she's of poor character, you don't like her traits, you don't like her values, you don't like her goals, you don't like what her life stands for, there's nothing stopping you from saying that. And if you know the research in psychology, you can draw upon research there. It's just when you cross the line and start talking illness, health, sickness, I think then it becomes problematic.
Dan, about a minute before our break, an email from Bob says, what does Hillary's false claim about taking sniper fire when landing in Bosnia say about her? And we are talking about two candidates that have what are called, I guess, high negatives.
Right. Well, I mean, PolitiFact has looked into the statements that the candidates make, and Hillary Clinton makes a fair number of false statements, about 29% or something like that, they calculate. Donald Trump's like in the mid-70s, and so he's like leading the league in that. Most politicians prevaricate to a certain extent, they exaggerate and so on. That's probably an example of Mrs. Clinton doing that. But if you want to just go straight up, one-on-one, Mr. Trump beats her by about 3-1, I think, on false statements.
And that's Dan McAdams, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Again, professor of psychology at Northwestern University, wrote a book called George Bush and the Redemptive Dream, A Psychological Portrait. And we've been talking about psychiatrists and perhaps even psychologists and others throwing around diagnoses, things like narcissism and sociopathy, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. And we're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get some callers in the conversation. And then we have a third guest who will be joining us after just a couple of minutes, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Let me get, looks like Jonathan to join our conversation, and he's calling us from Mount Airy. Jonathan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty.
Sure.
I think there's a diagnosis that has never appeared in the DSM that absolutely nails Donald Trump. And interestingly enough, it was established by a psychologist, Eric Fromm, back in the 1960s, and later refined by a psychiatrist, Otto Kernberg. And that diagnosis is malignant narcissism. And if that doesn't fit Donald Trump to a T, I don't know what does. And I'm interested in your guest's comments on that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling in. Would you go for that, Dan? Malignant narcissism?
No. Well, first of all, I don't go for diagnoses. And with great respect for Mr. Fromm, Eric Fromm, he did make that label. To call it a diagnosis suggests it's a certain kind of mental illness. Probably what he had in mind is pretty close to what the DSM category suggests is narcissistic personality disorder. The fact that it's a disorder suggests that it's malignant in the sense that it's a problem. It gets in the way of things. It's problematic. Again, I shy away from the diagnosis. So, I'm not wild about doing that.
Okay, fair enough. How easy is it for anyone, a psychologist, psychiatrist, or frankly anyone, to predict how someone would be if they became president of the United States?
It's very difficult. And you could say it's even more difficult in the case of Mr. Trump than in other candidates because he's never held political office before of any kind. and has never been in these kinds of situations. And so we're talking probabilistic kinds of predictions about, in the case of personality traits, about a person's style of decision-making, their demeanor, and so forth. But again, probabilistic in the sense that people often do defy the predictions and so forth. So it's better than a chance prediction that Donald Trump, if he were in office, would be a very bold, I think, and perhaps somewhat careless kind of leader, which comes from the traits. But, of course, you don't know for sure.
And how about, this is our final question, then we'll get our third guest in on the conversation before we have to say goodbye to you, Dan. But is there a way to describe then the supporters of Donald Trump? Are there certain features, psychological features about them that you can glean?
Well, I mean, there are many supporters across the board, but I mean, a lot has been written and discussed. I talked about a little bit in the piece regarding his relationship with his supporters and the kind of authoritarian relationship that he has established. And he's not the first candidate to have this kind of thing, but it is something that I think can be seen as somewhat dangerous. Many of Mr. Trump's supporters, not all of them, but a significant number, see him in almost messianic terms. I'm not saying he sees himself that way, but they see him as a savior. They see him as somebody who's going to come here and restore the kind of life maybe that we had once upon a time, or fix things magically and so on. This kind of dynamic between a leader and his or her followers, I think, is problematic. It leads to humongous expectations that are surely to be dashed down the road. And so I think that the kind of relationship bothers me a lot. It scares me a little bit. I don't know if it speaks to the kind of people who are attracted to Mr. Trump so much as what goes on between Mr. Trump and his followers.
Let me actually squeeze one more caller in before we have to say goodbye to you. And we've got Jennifer from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Jennifer, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Marty, for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just curious why we don't have psychological examinations for candidates, just in terms of understanding whether they have impulsivity issues or whether they do, you know, what their kind of psychological makeup is. I think we do that with the military, people who join the military services. Why don't we do that for people in the executive branch?
Jennifer, I appreciate the call. Dan, do you have a position on that?
So is the question, why don't we do psychiatric evaluations?
Yes, the way we do for people in the military, for instance.
Yeah. It's a democracy. We vote on candidates for many, many different reasons. I just can't imagine a situation where we would have some sort of board that would pass judgment on the mental health of a candidate. It just seems un-American and undemocratic.
On that note, Dan McAdams, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Professor of psychology at Northwestern University, wrote a book called George Bush and the Redemptive Dream, A Psychological Portrait, had a piece in The Atlantic recently called The Mind of Donald Trump. Well, joining us now is Paul Applebaum. He's a professor of psychiatry, medicine, and law, also director of the Division of Law, Ethics, and Psychiatry at Columbia University. And he's the past president of the American Psychiatric Association. And Paul Applebaum, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We've been talking about this golden rule and Donald Trump and the APA. Where do you stand on that?
Oh, I'm a strong supporter of the Goldwater rule. I think much harm can come from psychiatrists and, in fact, other mental health professionals speaking about the diagnoses or even the personality traits of candidates who they haven't examined, and I think very little good can come from it.
Why not? Why is that not helpful for voters that want to figure out who these people are?
I think it's not helpful because from a distance, psychiatrists can't do the kind of evaluation that actually allows them to make a diagnosis or to understand the inner workings of someone's mind. When we evaluate someone, and sometimes we do this over a period of months before we have some real insight into what makes them tick, when we evaluate someone, we get to ask the questions. We get to push for answers. We get to rule out things that might be causing the kind of behavior that we're seeing, and we get to rule in other kinds of causative factors. None of that is possible when I'm watching someone on TV or listening to them on the radio, I just don't have the kind of information I would need to make that kind of judgment. So I'm highly likely to be wrong. And you can see that if you go back to 1964 when the Goldwater versus Johnson contest occurred that precipitated the 1973 adoption of the Goldwater rule. Psychiatrists who responded to the public survey conducted by Fact magazine back then had a slew of diagnoses to offer, many of them at the most extreme ends of the mental illness spectrum, and all of them wrong.
Hmm.
And this is a phenomenon that is not unique to 2016. I think it's important to recognize that this seems to recur every 4 years, that with every presidential election, there are a group of mental health professionals who conclude that one or another of the candidates represents an existential threat to the United States, and that it's up to them to inform the public about why that is in psychiatric or psychological terms. This is very gratifying for many of my colleagues, but highly inaccurate and very misleading.
Let me ask you, do you make a distinction, and I was talking with my previous guest about this, a distinction between a diagnosis and a description? And I'm thinking about, as it stands now, we have candidates who write books, who give speeches, who tweet comments. There's a lot of what could be a psychological paper trail to at least come up with a description for somebody. Do you oppose that as well?
Yeah, so let me respond in two ways. One is to look at the wording of the Goldwater rule itself. It reads in part, it is unethical for a psychiatrist to offer a professional opinion unless he or she has conducted an examination and been granted proper authorization. So we're not just talking about diagnoses. We're talking about psychiatrists standing in the public forum and by virtue of their professional training purporting that they have some knowledge that the rest of the populace doesn't have about someone. And sometimes when I talk about this issue, people ask me, you know, don't you have some impressions? How could you listen to the candidates without forming some judgment about them, just watching what they do, listening to what they say? And of course, I have impressions, but you have impressions, too. And so do all your callers and all your listeners. And if what I'm doing is describing what I see Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump do or say, I'm not particularly adding very much to this discussion about who should be president, because I'm really not bringing my psychiatric expertise to bear. And so I either have little to say beyond what you could observe yourself, or I'm pretending to know something that I can't possibly know because I've never evaluated the person.
Are you concerned that opining about a candidate's either mental health or mental fitness hurts your profession, hurts the profession of psychiatry?
So I'm less concerned about harm to the profession than I am about harm to our patients. And I see that potential for harm occurring in two ways. One is I'm concerned that people who might actually benefit from psychiatric or other mental health treatment will watch the circus that is going on now with therapists of varying persuasions offering conflicting diagnoses and personality assessments and conclude that the mental health professions are all a lot of bunk and couldn't possibly be of assistance to them and will therefore decide not to get treatment that might be highly beneficial for them. So that's number one. Number two, I'm concerned about the harm that comes when we don't like the way somebody behaves and we put a label of a psychiatric disorder on it. And if you look at the social media comments by people who have mental disorders and have, you know, struggled with them and made good lives for themselves nonetheless, you see that they are very angered and saddened by the tendency to call anyone who you don't like crazy or to put a psychiatric label on them as if having a psychiatric disorder and being a bad person or suggesting bad policies were one in the same. And they feel assaulted and understandably so by that practice.
This may be an overly dramatic question for you, but I was thinking of that duty to warn. And I know that psychiatrists, psychologists, if they feel that someone is either a danger to themselves or to others, they do have a responsibility to warn. If a psychiatrist felt that way about a particular candidate, should they keep that to themselves?
So I can see the appeal of that argument, and there are several of the public commentators about the mental health of the candidates this year who have appealed to that justification for their behavior. But I would encourage them to look back at the last 40 or so, 50 or so years of our history and note that in every presidential election, somebody feels that way. Somebody feels that one or the other of the candidates is a clear and present danger. And remarkably enough, that judgment comports with their pre-existing political inclinations. And I would encourage them to ask themselves just how valid their conclusion is likely to be and the extent to which it may simply be a reflection of their own very strongly held political views. Some insight on the part of the mental health professionals involved here could go a long way.
Let me get Steve from Newtown to join our conversation. And Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. I was a therapist for 25 years, and part of this is a no-brainer. Of course, there is no therapist that can diagnose anyone, politician, movie actor, anything, who they haven't had as their personal client. And so, of course, that's a no-brainer. And it's also probably true that people in certain professions like politics and acting and all have narcissism. Lots of people have narcissism. It's huge egos and all this. But one of your guests did finally say, I've been waiting for this, to talk about, we're not just talking about egomania or narcissism, we're talking about this pervasive pattern to meet that criteria for the personality disorder.
And Steve, I'm looking at the clock here. We're almost out of time. If you can just get right to your point.
Yeah, it's not fair to talk about anybody from Lincoln to Obama as having a personality disorder because there might be some narcissism. There's nothing clinically significant we know about that. With Trump, there's a pattern that's much more disturbing. I think that's why so many people are talking about it. They shouldn't be diagnosing, but they should be concerned about when it reaches the level where you're saying the president created ISIS and things like this, or in tacky gold star families. There's a pattern that seems disturbing that I think people should look at because it's unprecedented that anybody would be saying those kinds of things and still running for office and still being a candidate for that high office. Or he doesn't know that Putin's been in Ukraine for a couple of years. He thinks these things come closer to being significant.
Yeah, and I got to jump in here.
Narcissism is blinding you to reality. And well, in that sense, I think people should be concerned, but not be diagnosing.
Fair enough. Let me give Paul Applebaum a chance. We have 45 seconds, so sorry about that,
sure,
Paul.
Sure, so very, very quickly, yep. I just am dubious that a psychiatric label or a personality label adds anything to the discussion here. If you don't think somebody who doesn't know that Russia invaded Ukraine should be president of the United States, don't vote for that person. But you don't need a psychiatric label to tell you that. I think we can listen to what people say, look at their past behavior, draw judgments about the policies they propose, and we can and should make our decisions on that basis.
But not without a but excluding and you're saying a diagnosis is not necessary.
I'm saying a diagnosis doesn't add anything to that consideration.
Well, Paul Applebaum, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's a professor of psychiatry, medicine, and law, and director of the Division of Law, Ethics, and Psychiatry at Columbia University, and the past president of the American Psychiatric Association. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program. You can carry on the conversation. We started this hour of the show. You can send us an email and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us for Radio Times. We'll be right back.